From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, why nearly half of all Michiganders just can't make ends meet.
There are undoubtedly people in your own personal social network in your neighborhood. You may not see it, but there are folks who are one crisis away from, you know, missing meals or missing the rent.
We'll celebrate today's vernal equinox.
You know, I think if you look through the lens of history, you see that human beings are always trying to live in harmony with their environment.
Michiganders in the 1800s loved vibrant, colorful wallpaper, but there was a dark secret about that paper.
Well, a lot of those colors were made using poisonous materials.
Plus, the MSU professor who explores the concept of a wall through his orchestral music. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is the first day of spring, and a little later in the program, we'll talk about some spring equinox cultural traditions. But first, Michigan is recovering from the Great Recession with overall improvement in employment, gains in median income. That's what the numbers tell us. But that recovery is spotty at best. Many Michiganders are struggling, including people with jobs, people working hard, trying to make a living, and falling short. They are ALICE, an acronym for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, Employed. ALICE has an income above the federal poverty level, but just cannot make ends meet. The Michigan Association of United Ways today released its latest ALICE report, and you will be stunned to hear how many of us in Michigan are struggling. Kyle Dubuck is with the United Way for Southeastern Michigan. He joins us now from Lansing, where he's talking with lawmakers about the findings of this ALICE report. Kyle, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Before we talk numbers and just how many households in Michigan cannot make ends meet, I want to talk about why this report matters. Because there are so many common stereotypes and cliches and tropes about people who cannot make ends meet. And most of them, frankly, are pretty judgy and boil down to blaming the person who's struggling as if it's somehow their fault. So this report changes that narrative. Tell us just who is ALICE?
I think one of the most important takeaways from this report is that ALICE families, which are those who are working but can't afford their most basic needs, cut across every single demographic and geography in our state. They exist in Lake County and Mason County and in Wayne County and everywhere in Michigan. There are way more of these families than one would expect to see. And the report demonstrates in clear detail that incredible number of people who are going to work every day, who are making the right decisions, who are playing by the rules, yet are still not afford to make the most basic household budget work month to month.
So as the Michigan Association of United Ways releases this ALICE report, what you're really talking about is everybody's neighbors and friends and loved ones and acquaintances.
Absolutely. I mean, given the sheer number of ALICE families that we see in the report, there are undoubtedly people in your own personal social network in your neighborhood who fall within, you know, under the ALICE threshold that, you know, you may not see it, but there are folks who are one crisis away from, you know, missing meals or missing the rent.
So how many households in Michigan, based on this latest report, cannot afford the basic needs? And by that, we're talking about housing, child care, food, transportation, health care, and a smartphone, which is frankly a must for many jobs.
So this report says that's 43% of Michigan households.
43%. So they're either working poor or they're below the federal poverty level.
Correct. And I think the federal poverty level is something that one of the reasons for the report is to demonstrate that federal poverty, while often used as a marker for, you know, how many people are economically struggling, you know, what does the working poor look like in our state or in our community, federal poverty is completely inadequate in capturing that number. That might be, you know, 12 to 18%, but in every single community, there's an additional 20 to 40 or 50% of ALICE families on top of that. That is people who are working, but can't make a household budget work.
The folks who are the ALICE households, they're making too much to qualify for so much of the help available to the people who fall below the federal poverty level. So it is a complete catch-22.
In many cases, that's exactly right, where it becomes difficult to get ahead, because if you do secure employment, all of a sudden you lose more in benefits or access to health care than you're actually going to bring in from that job. And that's, you know, one of the primary issues that we're seeing here is that wages have been stagnant while, you know, costs for transportation and health care and child care have dramatically outpaced inflation, and wages have not kept up. So even a family that was financially solvent, you know, 5-10 years ago, without, even if they haven't had substantial increases of their own in their own spending, just the very cost of living has outpaced their income, and that's what's driving this increase in Alice numbers.
You say 43% of households in Michigan can't afford basic needs. How has that number changed in the 5 years since the Michigan Association of United Ways began tracking, releasing the Alice report?
So I think what's shocking is that it's gone up. So we've seen, you know, a much celebrated economic recovery in our state, very low unemployment, but the number of Alice families has actually increased from 40 to 43%. So that's a 6% increase in the number of families who are working but still falling below this threshold. And that's, you know, very disturbing given that, you know, looking at your basic economic markers that, you know, have been much touted about Michigan, one would think we'd be seeing the opposite. But the recovery has not impacted everyone equally, and a lot of families are not sharing in the prosperity that we've seen growing in Michigan.
And what about if you thought of the map of Michigan? Have there been changes in where the most dense populations of people who fall into the Alice category live? Or is it less important to talk about where the dense populations are, because your point is these families are everywhere?
Well, these families are everywhere. There's definitely been increases in places where you would not expect it. For example, in Oakland County, which is recognized as one of the most prosperous counties in Michigan, in 2017, you had 20% of households were Alice households. Now in 2019, there's 24%. And that's a substantial increase. Again, particularly considering the wealth and prosperity associated with Oakland County, which is, you know, within the service area of my United Way. But we know that families, particularly those that have transitioned, say, out of the automotive sector into new jobs, are not making the same wages and are not seeing the kind of benefits that they had previously enjoyed, and that's driving household economic instability.
I'm speaking with Kyle Dubuck of the United Way for Southeastern Michigan as we dig into the newly released ALICE report. ALICE is an acronym for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, Employed. In short, people who are working. They are going and reporting to jobs, and they still can't make enough to make ends meet. So let's talk about why. You know, we say, gee, employment is up. Overall employment has improved in Michigan. But what does that employment look like on the ground for these families?
So I think the kind of jobs that we've attracted and that have been growing in the state, you know, service sector jobs in particular, are not paying the wages that of our previous manufacturing industry jobs that were really drove a thriving working middle class in the state of Michigan. That transition, in addition to the growth of the gig economy, which is people transitioning out of working for a major sector employer into independent contracting, technically working for themselves without any wages or job security from month to month, which is creating radical shifts in what they're bringing down in any given month, is driving household economic instability.
I also see that there have been changes in the demographics of just who is falling into this category of ALICE. Talk about that for us.
One of the major shifts we saw in this year's report is actually more seniors falling within the ALICE demographic. So you have folks who planned appropriately for their retirement and are on a fixed income. But again, the increases in cost of living that they did not anticipate are now making it so they're having to choose between medical care, transportation, or paying utilities. And seniors in general don't have a lot of options for bringing in new income as they planned for this retirement decades ago.
Broadly speaking, what could make things better? What could help more people out of ALICE?
So there's a lot we can do, and one of the reasons that we're here in Lansing today meeting with legislators is because this is indicative, as I think you started with, this is not about folks not trying hard enough or 43% of our families being in some way flawed and need fixing. This is a massive systemic issue that requires substantive policy change and private sector change. From the United Way perspective, there's a few public policy issues that we are particularly aggressively supporting, first of which is access to quality, affordable child care. Mm-hmm. Not only is this a cost driver for families trying to enter the workforce and a barrier for some when they see that child care for a family of four can actually cost more than your mortgage or your rent and food budget combined, that's a pretty serious barrier for someone who sees the job is actually going to pay less than child care to enter the job market. Second is the earned income tax credit. We've been longtime supporters of the tax credit. We were very disappointed, back when they shifted around the Michigan business tax. And one of the changes that happened was we dramatically reduced our earned income tax credit from 20% of the federal level to 6%. The governor is proposing doubling that, which we celebrate, and we're glad that there's recognition that this is a very effective tool to keep working families financially stable and set them on a path to prosperity. But that doubling is really it's offsetting some of the proposed and necessary revenue increases, the gas tax and other new costs that will impact families. So it's a wash for working families, which is great, mm-hmm. but we'd prefer to see that go a little bit further so that we're actually increasing families' incomes to see more families get above that ALICE threshold.
There you are in Lansing today to talk with lawmakers and stakeholders and present this report. Is it hard to get attention for the ALICE report when there are so many other worrisome reports?
Well, I think it's very timely right now, given that the budget is on the tip of everyone's tongue, and a lot of solutions do require some sort of investment by the state. Particularly EITC and increasing the child care subsidy. But absolutely, there's a lot of stakeholders here. There's a lot of folks, here in the Capitol today, advancing their causes. And I think what we have going for us is that the ALICE report brings something unique to the table. I mean, this is real, tangible data that recognizes that every single Senate district and House district has an overrepresentation of these families. And I would think that legislators from across the aisle would be very motivated to come together and find ways to address the needs of these families to make sure that the people in their districts have an opportunity to become financially stable and ideally financially prosper going forward.
Kyle Dubuck, United Way for Southeastern Michigan, on the latest ALICE report. Thank you so much for being with us, Kyle.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
And you can learn more about the economic and living conditions in your county by going to MichiganALICE.org. Coming up, an MSU music professor composes a concerto for maracas.
The maracas in Venezuela are like, I guess, hamburgers in the U.S. I mean, they are a staple of what our culture is about.
We'll be back after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Let's turn to cherries. For the past decade, Americans have been buying tart cherries from Turkey, and they've been getting them cheap. But tart cherry farmers in Michigan say that is hurting their bottom line. Now they're hoping a new bill in Washington will balance the scales. Interlochen Public Radio's Max Johnston has the story.
It's a sunny day at a cherry orchard north of Cedar. There's about a foot of snow on the ground as Ben LaCrosse, a second-generation cherry farmer, prunes some young cherry trees with electric shears.
We're trying to open up the scaffolds of the limbs to allow more light in and to force the tree to grow in the direction that we want it to.
Tart cherries like these are used by food manufacturers in things like cherry pies and turnovers. LaCrosse hopes that come spring, this pruning will maximize the orchard's yield. That would mean a lot, because many tart cherry farmers across Michigan are treading water. They face stiff foreign competition, specifically from the country of Turkey, who for years has flooded U.S. markets with their tart cherries. When this started around 2012, it was actually a good thing. Domestic cherry farmers had a few bad years in a row, and Turkish cherries came in and met demand. But when U.S. crops bounced back, farmers were boxed out. Turkey's cherries were going for about half the price of domestic ones, and farmers like La Crosse are calling foul.
So every year we're dealing with these Turkish cherries, we're looking at basically a loss year on our farms.
They're cheaper because evidence suggests tart cherries are highly subsidized by the Turkish government, and until a few months ago, came into the U.S. tariff-free. La Crosse and others say those subsidies allow Turkey to sell them below the cost of production.
If we can't defend our domestic market against unfair foreign competition, we might as well not be in business anymore.
According to the Cherry Marketing Institute, the U.S. was importing about 24 million pounds of Turkish cherry products annually in 2008. Since then, that number has gone up by nearly 700%. For a long time, there wasn't much tart cherry farmers could do about all this. Unlike bigger industries, they aren't equipped to go after an entire country's trade practices. So U.S. Senator Gary Peters wants the federal government to step in. He introduced legislation last month to make the Commerce Department investigate those Turkish subsidies.
We need the Department of Commerce to be much more aggressive when it comes to looking at actions being taken by foreign countries to undercut particularly small industries.
If they find out those cherries are heavily subsidized, the U.S. can levy tariffs to offset the price difference. Gary Peters says that's on the table.
The key is to level the price, is to make a price that is consistent with what it actually costs to grow cherries and not to be subsidized from the government.
President Trump says his administration wants to help Michigan's cherry farmers.
I think it's a fantastic idea because you're right. They can't hire the lawyers. It's too small, but it's, you know, in a double way, it's very, very big.
In the fall, his administration put a small tariff on tart cherry juice concentrate from Turkey. Michigan cherry farmers say that's a good sign, but it's mostly a symbolic gesture that the president is on their side. Many want steeper tariffs on more products. But Alan Deardorff says that may have some unintended consequences. He's a professor of international economics at the University of Michigan. Deardorff says tariffs may drive cherry prices up, but that would bring demand down.
You're trying to raise the price for your producers so that they'll be better off. And you're willing to do that even though you know you're going to inflict more harm on the buyers.
Cherry farmer Ben La Crosse says food manufacturers that make cherry pies and turnovers would bear the brunt of any price hike, not consumers. And even if cherry prices go up at the grocery store, La Crosse says they would still be cheaper than a decade ago, before Turkish cherries took off. Ultimately, he says U.S. farmers just want a level playing field.
We welcome competition, but it has to be fair. We can't compete against a product with both of our hands tied behind our backs, and that's where we are right now.
For Stateside, I'm Max Johnston.
Just how do artists, musicians respond to the social and political events that happen around them? MSU professor and chair of music composition Ricardo Lorenz is a prime example of a composer connecting his music with the world around him. He's from Venezuela. He's lived in the U.S. since 1982, but maintains very close ties with Latin America. On March 21st, the MSU Wind Symphony will premiere his concerto titled Pararuco, written for Venezuela maracas. Ricardo Lorenz, welcome to Stateside. So good to have you with us.
It's great to be here, Cynthia. Thank you.
So a concerto for maracas, I think most of us would not associate that instrument with a symphony.
There's other percussion instruments associated with orchestras, but not maracas. Maracas and the style of maracas I use for this concerto are particularly, they stem from Venezuela and Colombia. And you can't find them anywhere else in Latin America and the world for that matter.
Tell us what the maracas mean to Venezuela.
The maracas in Venezuela are like, I guess, hamburgers in the U.S. I mean, they're a staple of what our culture is about. It's a very, very simple instrument, perhaps an instrument that we play as babies. I mean, everybody can shake a pair of maracas, but they are developed to a level of sophistication that you can only find, as I said, in Venezuela and in Colombia. In those two countries, the maracas are like the drum set for jazz, in that they're not just accompanying music in the background, but they're actually a lot of times in the foreground, always ornamenting the music and responding to the music. And sometimes they're even as important as the melody that another instrument is playing.
What gave you the inspiration to incorporate the maracas into an orchestral piece? Because I know you wrote it initially, this piece, for maracas and orchestra.
Yes, and that's a really interesting story that takes us to what's called transculturation, and that's sort of the journey that cultures take. And what happened was that when I lived in Chicago, I came across a percussionist who had lived in Venezuela. He's actually born in New Jersey, but he lived in Venezuela in the early 80s, and he played in one of the many symphony orchestras there. While playing timpani for the Philharmonic Orchestra in Venezuela, he became acquainted with the maraca technique and became an avid performer. When he returned to the U.S., he became a spokesperson for the maracas. And he was the one who brought the idea to me of writing a concerto for maracas and orchestra. And to tell you the truth, I laughed. You know, and that's the interesting thing. You know, we don't tend to appreciate what our cultures can do and the significance of it until somebody from outside the culture invites us to appreciate it. So that's the way this concerto came about. It was a guy from New Jersey who presented this project to me.
Tell us about the choice of that word, pataruco. What does that mean?
So pataruco is, it's a nickname given to people that are cocky to the point of appearing ill-mannered, a little bit out of taste. And actually, I found name in a book story by a famous Venezuelan author. His name is Romulo Gallegos, and he was actually the first president in the series of democratic governments we had in Venezuela since late 50s all the way to the late 90s. So he was both a politician and an author, and he has a book called Pataruco, and it's a book that tells the story of a young child that has the typical conflict between who one is and who wants to pretend to be, and this whole conflict between foreign influence and local influence. And that's where I took the name Pataruco. Eventually, later, I found out that it's a word that fell out of use and then more recently came back, believe it or not, used to as a nickname to the late Hugo Chavez.
Oh, and in effect, didn't you write this the same year that Chavez was elected president of Venezuela?
Yes.
1999.
Which is, yeah, it's almost like, wow, who would have predicted that? But I wrote it in 1998, and it was premiered in 1999. Yeah, and he was elected in 1998.
How do you feel with the idea of this being performed now when we see the turmoil and the things that are happening right now in Venezuela?
Well, first, it made me think of how long these cycles are. I mean, it's taken Venezuela 20 years to get to a moment where it's unsustainable. The government is unsustainable, but it's taken 20 years for us to get to that point. The piece, the Pataruco, is 20 years old as well. So it gives me a sense of the timing of these political processes. And it also makes me think that even though the turmoil, the social and political turmoil in the country, there's still young individuals trying to do art, trying to have a meaningful life. And an example of that is the artist that we're bringing to perform the maraca solo part, Manuel Rangel, who's a young percussionist, And he lives in Venezuela, and he's still making music, and he's still traveling and trying to spread the word about Venezuelan culture.
You reached out to us to tell us about a piece you had composed in 2008 called El Muro, Spanish for the wall. And you wrote to us not long after the end of our government shutdown, which, of course, was triggered by President Trump's demand for funding for his wall at our southern border. And you say El Muro is your response to how you feel about walls. Tell us more about that.
Yes. I was actually telling my colleague here, Kevin, that maybe I would have never composed a piece this year called El Muro, the wall. Looking back in 2008 when I composed the piece, yes, I responded to this issue, which is ongoing. It's certainly not a contemporary topic by any means. But there was some distance back then. It was not as heated as it is today, this whole issue of border security and constructing a wall as a response. Back then, it wasn't the news, of course, but I had enough distance from it, and it was enough in the background that I thought it would make a good topic for a piece of music. And my idea was to find the positive spin behind the idea of building walls. And I have experiences with walls because I grew up in Caracas, and Caracas, as I like to think of it, is a makeshift fortress. Every single house in Caracas is surrounded by a big concrete wall or a brick wall and barbed wire. And I've always thought that it's simply a symbol of fear more than anything else. So I thought, is it possible to create the illusion of building a wall, but in sound as opposed to with bricks?
And you really want to make a point in this piece about the power of music to make walls tumble down.
Yeah, my idea was, well, can I create the illusion of first building a wall in sound where each brick of a wall would be actually a snippet of music, and then build it to the point that there's so much tension that the wall inevitably has to come down. And at the end of the piece, I play a trick that gives us that impression, and it's always effective. And I think the piece is performed so much, pretty much because of the ending. It surprises everyone.
Many of your works out there were written for full symphonies, strings, and the whole shebang, but they're being reworked now for wind symphony. What does that offer you? What kind of opportunity does that offer you?
So yes, there's a big difference between the symphony orchestra and the wind symphony. And that is that the symphony orchestra has a big body of string instruments and the wind symphony doesn't. The wind symphony has become the instrument of choice now by many composers in the United States, simply because they don't have the repertoire that the symphony orchestra has, a repertoire that goes back at least 300 years. So the wind symphony orchestra has had to build a repertoire, and that's where we composers come in, and that's where the collaboration between wind symphony conductors and composers have been a driving force of contemporary music in the United States right now. Case in point is the version of Pataruco that audiences are going to hear on March 21st. A piece is originally written for symphony orchestra in Maracas, and Travis Higa, who is a young wind symphony conductor, did a transcription of Pataruco for wind symphony. So it's the same piece, no strings, but then instead of strings, Higa uses saxophones and percussion and euphoniums and instruments that you don't normally hear in a symphony orchestra.
I think of those young musicians, Michigan State University, University of Michigan wind symphony, playing your compositions. What do you think the seeds that you can plant for these young minds, learning about the intersection of art and the events that happen in the world around them?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I think at one level, The first thing that I see them reacting to is the way I think about music in a very technical way. As I said, this sonic wall that I build is made out of little snippets of music. And those snippets of music are influenced by all the music I grew up with. It has, you know, it has the DNA of the tango, of the danzón, of the Mexican son, of the cumbia. And I first see them becoming acquainted with these very particular rhythms and timbres. And that's the first level of communication I see happening there. And then the second level of communication is that when they realize, oh, I see why we're doing all this, and when they get the full picture and they get to realize, oh, there's a concept supporting all these technicalities in the music. And that process is really interesting to witness and see a young musician, you know, taking it from not having any idea what this piece is about or what it sounds like to getting a full picture of art in general, not only music.
Well, we should note there is a CD coming out soon from the Michigan State University Wind Symphony, which will feature Ricardo's compositions. There's King Mangleberry. There is going to be El Muro and Pataruco. So people can kind of give me driving and listening to the music. That's the beauty of something like a CD. It goes anywhere. But the upcoming performance is going to be on March 21st. The MSU Wind Symphony will premiere this concerto, Pataruco, written for Venezuelan maracas. And we've been speaking with Ricardo Lorenz, who's the professor and chair of music composition at MSU. What a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
Likewise, Cynthia. It's been a pleasure.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Coming up, you've probably heard of the dangers of lead paint, but how about arsenic wallpaper?
As the colors start to just fade and disintegrate, they're creating a poisonous dust that's laying throughout the house.
That historic story after the break. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is Wednesday, and you know that means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. It's Poison Awareness Week this week in Michigan. Recent tragedies, including the Flint water crisis and the dangers of PFAS in our water, is raising the awareness of the presence of toxins in our everyday lives. But people have been sounding the alarm of these hazards for longer than you might think. In the 1970s, Michigan had the PBB crisis. New York had the Love Canal poisoning. And before that, DDT. Rachel Carson's Silent Spring put environmental toxins on everyone's radar screen. But how about this? In 1874, Dr. Robert Kedzie in Michigan sounded an alarm for poisonous wallpaper. Joining us now from the Michigan History Center is Rachel Clark. So, Rachel, who was Dr. Robert Kedzie?
Dr. Kedzie, that name probably sounds familiar to most Michigan State University alum, but he grew up in Ohio. He is part of the first graduating class at the University of Michigan Medical School in 1851, so Wolverines probably recognize him too.
Okay.
He was a Civil War surgeon, and in 1863, he came back to Michigan and started teaching at what is now Michigan State University. He stayed there until his death in 1902. But his role with the first State Board of Health in Michigan is sort of what we're going to be talking about today with his work with the wallpaper.
All right. Wallpaper does not sound particularly dangerous, or was it? What was Dr. Kedzie warning people about?
The mid and early 19th century, wallpapers, if you think about the Victorian era, and very loud patterns, very flowery, lots of animals, lots of colors. Well, a lot of those colors were made using poisonous materials. And there, in the mid-19th century, green became a very popular color. And the way to get the various hues of green was to mix it with arsenic. And so most of the wallpaper that was being produced at that time was made with a green hue, which also could be turned into beautiful blues and greens and anything in between. But most of it was made using arsenic.
And how did Dr. Kedzie become aware of this problem, of this environmental problem?
It had been brought to the attention of the Massachusetts Board of Health a couple of years prior to this. And he was very concerned. He started testing various wallpapers in Michigan. And he didn't think that people were concerned enough about it. They just thought, eh, that's Massachusetts. That's not our problem. And so he ended up presenting to the Board of Health, as I said, in 1873, just to say, yes, this is Michigan. And in his presentation, he brought up actual examples of people who had become sick, especially children who had either bedrooms or playrooms with this wallpaper in it. So he'd known about it, but he just didn't feel like the alarm had been raised enough.
In fact, the committee that he chaired, I think, has the best name ever. It is, he was chairman of Committee of Poisons, Explosives, Chemicals, Accidents, and Special Sources of Danger to Life and Health. Boy, that tells us that the good old days, we could look at them through Kodachrome vision, but there were some big hazards in everyday things back in the good old days.
He was a chemist, so he would have known about anything that would explode or cause hazards at that time or poison people.
Well, like oil lamps, I'm sure, yes.
He did a report that same year on the dangers of the different oils that were being used in household lamps. And women were having these accidents where they're lighting lamps and their clothing was catching fire. And so he is sounding the alarm for not just the arsenic wallpaper issue, but other household issues that are creating hazards to people in Michigan.
Let's go back to the wallpaper. How did Dr. Robert Kedzie go about kind of broadcasting this warning? There was no mass media back then.
No, he, in 1873, as I said, he appeared in front of the State Board of Health in Michigan, stating his concerns. He's giving examples. He's talking about not just the wallpaper at this point, but all of the different materials that are being used with these color greens. So the U.S. Express Company, which was a early mail company, they would wrap their packages and their labels were made with these green tints. Toys, playing cards, so many things were being produced with this arsenic color that he presented to the board in 1873. And then in 1874, he published a book called Shadows from the Walls of Death. He made 100 copies. And it was sample about 80 some odd samples of various wallpapers that contained arsenic. And he was doing it not only to show the different styles and patterns where it was found, but also the colors, because it wasn't just this really bright, pretty green. These very pretty light blues, and even colors that don't look like they have green at all in them, had arsenic. So he was sending out these examples to universities and libraries all over the state so people could be educated on what exactly this poison wallpaper looked like.
And was this an effective tactic? Did people listen to him?
They did. Arsenic poisoning wasn't new, but it was considered sort of a lower working class problem. People who worked in manufacturing industries suffered from arsenic and lead poisonings often. But this turned it into a middle class and upper class problem, and it brought it into people's homes. So you see people beginning to have this wallpaper removed, which was a task into itself. You had to get it very, very wet because the problem was dust that was being created. As the colors start to just fade and disintegrate, they're creating a poisonous dust that's laying throughout the house. And so what you have to do is wet that wallpaper down considerably to then bring it off. And so people start having it removed from their homes, and then industry starts to find different ways to create these colors without using the poisonous materials like arsenic.
This really foreshadows the whole lead paint issue that we've been dealing with in recent decades, and even, you know, the idea of careful removal of lead paint. The abatement steps have to be very specific. So it sounds like it was quite similar.
Yes. And if you have, I mean, I'm not an expert in this. Please do not take my word as golden on this. But people did also just wallpaper over top of the poisonous wallpaper because it was sort of simpler. So there very well may be poison wallpaper still underneath other layers of wallpaper somewhere, just like there's lead paint hiding in nooks and crannies of older homes.
Rachel, what happened to those 100 books? Are there any survivors?
There are. Most of them were destroyed because they're poisonous. But most references cite 4 surviving copies, but there are actually 5 surviving copies. Harvard University has one. The National Library of Medicine has one. The University of Michigan has one. Michigan State University has one. And the Michigan History Museum has one.
You
so there's
one
in my building.
And do you have to be careful when you handle it?
Yes, we do. I actually had the great pleasure of looking at it. It is beautiful, I will say. The wallpaper is absolutely stunning. But the way that it is stored, it's stored encased in multiple layers of plastic. And I had to wear multiple layers of gloves and a mask as I was looking through it.
Well, it's a good reminder this Poison Awareness Week that this is not not a new problem and not a new issue. And a hat tip to Dr. Robert Kedzie, Michigan State University chemist, for sounding the alarm about poisonous wallpaper. And what a wonderful title, Shadows from the Walls of Death. Rachel, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. This was a lot of fun.
Today is the first day of spring, also known as the vernal equinox. In many cultures, this event is marked by very festive celebrations. Let's get into our long history of celebrating the start of spring. And for that, we turn to star lore historian Mary Stuart Adams. She established Michigan's only international dark sky park in Mackinac City, but she's here with us now. So exactly what time is the vernal equinox? When do we say, hello, spring?
Well, so in the Eastern time zone, it's exactly at 5:58 p.m. today.
Okay, so we can say, see you later, winter. Hello, spring. And why is it that the equinox is just so important across so many cultures and across time?
Yeah. You know, I think if you look through the lens of history, you see that human beings are always trying to live in harmony with their environment. It might not look that way in the 21st century, but the further back you go in history, you see that all of the civic organization, all of the sacred festivals, all of the ways that human beings practice their lifestyle was rooted in trying to understand what has that overhead got to do with me down here on the earth.
And going back very, very far, we have to remember they didn't have websites to check or
right, you couldn't
calendars.
Just Google it. Yeah.
You just watched the sky and you tried to figure out what was going on.
Right. So there would be those who could read the sky. You know, the most learned would be the ones that would do the observation. And you have to do it every day from the same place. And then that's where the sacred site would be developed. And that's where you would practice the marriage or honor the dead or do all of the festivals that held the community together. And so knowing when the sun comes to that place where now it's going to return to your region, you'll have more sunlight, that was a time for celebration.
Tell us about some of the unique celebrations of the equinox around the world that have really kind of caught your attention.
I grew up just outside of a Christian church. I didn't belong to it, and I wasn't taught that. But so I see the festival there, but I also have to share with you, I was born at the vernal full moon. It is the first full moon after the equinox, but in many traditions, that's the full moon that sets up when you do the festival. Because it's not just the sun returning. You have to have this witness that the sun has returned, and that's that moon. So I've spent a lifetime trying to figure out, like, oh, is that my moon? And what do I do with that moon? So you see that in the Jewish calendar, the Passover is dated to that moon. In the Christian calendar, the Easter festival. And so I've really kind of wandered mostly in that world. But there are other festivals that stick just to equinox. Oftentimes, they're festivals of flowers. There are festivals of the feminine. You know, Easter, it's in some places alleged that that's a word that comes from Ostara. And she's a goddess. She's a bringer of light. And so it's a festival of that return that comes from the feminine.
Did they also realize, all right, the agricultural societies that we are going to be planting soon, would there be festivals that were kind of ready to set things off
yeah.
on a positive note for this year's planting?
Yes, but actually that starts before equinox. It happens at the cross-quarter time, so halfway between winter solstice and spring equinox. We call it Groundhog's Day. In the United States, in Europe, it's called Candlemas Day. And I think in pagan cultures, it's referred to as the Feast of Bridget. And this is a time, like we say, if the groundhog sees its shadow, then we'll have more winter. But I have heard that that's actually referring to what phase is the moon in. And if the moon is at a darker phase, meaning it's either at crescent, waxing or waning, winter is going to come later. And that was for the people that were farming, like, watch the moon in February so you know when to get ready for the spring. Yeah, doing it now would be a little bit late.
A little bit late. You've missed the boat. You've missed the boat. When people look at something like the Old Farmer's Almanac, is that at all accurate, or is that just for fun?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, some of it is the lore. So lore is the story. It's the tale that one generation tells to another, or the way a culture keeps itself intact. These are the stories we got from our forebears, and these are the things we hand down to our children that they may or may not fit, but they kind of add color to life. And so in the Farmer's Almanac, they'll give you the names of the moon in different cultural traditions, but they'll also really look at what's going on, and then what can we see through a history of keeping track this way about what might happen. So what is the weather if we have a full moon at equinox like we will this year? You know, that's happened before. It happens actually every 19 years. So that's something that you can track and you can say, here's our experience of that.
Why is it important that we in, you know, here we are in 2019 and we can, a few clicks of a smartphone or your laptop, look anything up. Why is it important to stay tied in with these ancient traditions that are really centered on the stars?
Yeah, you know, to me, it's not so much staying connected to the ancient tradition. Of course, that's important. Primarily for me, it's about staying in the rhythm with the planet in its environment. So the Earth is our terrestrial body, but it's in a celestial environment and it has a relationship to the other bodies in its environment. And one of the quotes I often like to cite, it's from Rudolf Steiner, and he says, "The more abundantly the harmony of the cosmos fills the soul, the more peace and harmony there will be on the Earth." So there's this idea that if we strive to live in harmony with the natural environment, then we're bringing about a peaceful influence in the world. And that's why it matters, in particular equinox. You know, it's balanced. Day and night are balanced. And you could do that every day. We should do that. Find the point of balance in your day. But then when you can align it to when the Earth is coming to its point of balance, perhaps it has a little bit more power. It has more influence. It can bring some greater consequence into the world. So that's why I think we should.
Well, happy vernal equinox day.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks for asking.
Star lore historian Mary Stuart Adams, always a joy to talk with you.
Thanks.
Our stateside producers, Razi Jaffrey, Sarah Leeson, and Adam Reyes, reached out to three communities around our state celebrating the vernal equinox with their own special traditions. First, we hear from the leader in the Persian community about the equinox celebration of Nowruz.
My name is Zoreh Rain. We celebrate Nowruz, which is our national New Year, and we celebrate that on the first day of the spring. And a week before that, we celebrate Chorshanbe Suri. We burn the bushes, and when we jump over the fire, all my sickness and bad evils from me goes to the fire, and the heat and energy and light comes from the fire to me. Then on the first day of the spring, we set up a table, which we call it Haftsin, means 7S. And 7S goes for the things that we put on the table, and each of them has a symbol. Like apple is started with S in Farsi. It is the symbol of health and good diet. Then we have things that we make, all started with S. Garlic, symbol of get well and healthy. Goldfish, symbol of life. And we always dye eggs, and that's the symbol of fertilization. And usually the older people in the house, they read from either Quran or some poetry from the Hafez. So these are the memories that we have.
Now we hear from a pagan priest about what the vernal equinox means in the Wiccan community.
My name is Stanley Nunn. I am in the pagan community known as Nashan. I am the Wiccan priest at Pagan Pathways Temple in Madison Heights. The connection between spring and the pagan community is expressed in our ritual of Osara. It is a recognition of new opportunities, the rebirth of all things in the earth and in our lives. So this time is very important for us individually and as a group to recognize the opportunity that we can start over. There are a variety of different ways that the equinox is celebrated, but in more traditional ones, especially dealing with Wicca, you would find a symbolism like eggs, rabbits, things that symbolize rebirth and renewal. Personally, my favorite part of the equinox is the recognition within myself that I am a part of a continual cycle that began before me and that will continue long after I'm gone.
And finally, in the Hindu community, spring is marked with a festival of colors called Holi. Our producers visited a Hindu temple in Canton where people of all ages were gathered playing with colors, laughing, and celebrating the end of winter and beginning of spring.
My name, Girish Chalejaya. Holi is colors. Everything with the colors.
My name is Nandini Slecha. Well, if it's like warm outside, we like to throw colors at each other. That's kind of my favorite part of it.
My name is Manoj Kalyankar. Holi is a festival of colors, basically. I love that festival. I mean, it's a festival of making friendship, joy.
So my name is Sandeep Shant, and I'm the chairperson of UPAD.
I'm Dr. Bhupesh Sharma. I am one of the board of trustees of UPID. This is a festival. There's a lot of happiness. People are just celebrating that. And even the enemies become friends. You just go hug them. That's a spirit of Holi.
Very true, very true. You know, even in movies, Bollywood movies, they'll show that, you know, sworn enemies, they meet on the day of Holi and then they become friends, you know. They
forget. I'll sing a small song for Holi. Holi ke din dil mil jate hain, rangon mein rang mil jate hain. Enemies, they come and embrace each other, hug each other and
become friends.
No matter how you celebrate this spring equinox, it feels pretty nice to say goodbye winter and hello spring. And that's our show for today. Happy spring, everybody. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.